Any questions? Because this is the key to the whole thing. Once you've got this, the rest just drops into place. Any further questions on this? Yes.
The Christian Scientists be conscious, in as much as they say it's all in line, not in, or is that, would that be?
They're in that line. They're in that line. Yes.
It's not really broken. It's just in your mind.
Yes, that's insanity, of course. Yeah. Any other questions before we go on? Well, now in that case you probably have got the meaning of beyond the phenomena, on the other side of the phenomena from us. So beyond the phenomena, meaning things appearing as they appear. So the phenomena of the tree are a rustling that comes into my ear, some roughness that comes under my hand, some brown that's the trunk and some green that's the leaves. Those are the phenomena. Behind those phenomena, all is unknowable. It's just one big question mark. Behind the brown and the green and the rustling, I don't know if it's a tree. I don't know what it is. I can very well put together in my mind that it's a tree, but I can put together in my mind that it's a donkey. I mean, I can do as I like. My mind is active. The senses are passive to the phenomena, but the mind is no longer passive to the object. In Aristotle, the senses were passive to the phenomena, and the intelligence is passive to the form or essence of the thing. But now, my mind is no longer passive. My mind is active and is going to create the object. So that is the key to the whole encyclical. Now, we immediately start applying this principle. And we're going to take three examples. God, miracles, and revelation. Let's have a look. We'll leave Kant in place. And I hope this comparison helps, that the senses, my senses, carry the phenomena to the queen, which is the mind, and only the queen unlocks the essence which is, so to speak, inside the phenomena. And that's what Hume couldn't see. Hume thought that the senses simply bring sensation. Hume forgot that there's a treasure inside the box. He said there's only the box. No. If there was only the box, Hume would be quite right that I do not know that the white ball causes the red ball to move. But since there is the box, or the treasure inside the box, then not only do the senses bring to me the color, inside the sensation is also the reality of one ball causing the other to move, as the mind can pick up from the sensation. When the sensation says the white moves and stops and the red starts to move, the mind says that's cause. And that's Aristotle. The senses don't tell me that one causes the other. Hume is right. But the mind tells me that the one causes the other. And the mind picks that up from inside the sensations. So you see, Aristotle is right. So Aristotle is right. And these moderns are off the wall. However, let's now apply Kant's principle to a few cases. Firstly, God. We have Frankenstein admiring a sunset. Here's Frankenstein again. So there are three, we might make three examples. If we can get them down on one board. Here's Frankenstein. And here is the sunset. Now, I'm not a great artist, so don't laugh too much. There's the sunset. The phenomena of the sunset come to Frankenstein, and he sees a sunset, fine. But now, the Catholic looks at the sunset, and the essence, the reality behind, the intelligible reality inside the setting sun, is that this is a beautiful effect. Let's just say, a beautiful effect. The senses don't pick up the beauty. The senses pick up what is beautiful, but they don't pick up the beauty. The dog can't pick up the beauty. So the beauty is for the intelligence. The intelligence picks up this spectacle. The senses give me the spectacle, and the intelligence realizes the beauty. But it's a beautiful effect. And the intelligence says there's no effect without a cause. Our intelligence does say that. So the intelligence climbs up and down from a beautiful cause or beauty. Beauty cause. In other words, as St. Paul says in the Epistle to the Romans, those who, looking at the phenomena, do not appreciate that there is a great cause are inexcusable. That's more or less what he says. It's the most natural thing in the world for the human mind. Firstly, the beautiful effect imposes itself on my mind. My mind thinks and realizes that it's an effect, and from the effect, my mind then climbs to the cause. Right? But now, if that's the Catholic admiring the sunset, but now Kant admires the sunset, all of this is just completely wiped out. All of that is absolutely wiped out. What's behind the beautiful phenomena of the sunset? The Ding An Sich. I don't know what's behind it. So if I don't know even what's behind the effect, obviously I can't climb to the cause. So that's Kant admiring the sunset. There's just a bunch of phenomena coming off. And Kant can very well say, hey, this is my mind. That's ugly. That's ugly. Or that's a donkey. Or that's no different from the tramp walking down the street in a big city. The mind is no longer subject, can no longer pick up anything intelligible in the effect, and therefore still less can it pick up the intelligible cause. Therefore, for Kant to climb from the effect to the cause, for Kant to look at the realities and say there must be God, forget it. Forget it. So God, as the author of nature, is just wiped off the map. And all of the arguments for the existence of God from nature are just completely gutted. First example. Second example, miracles. Here's the Catholic at the miracle of Cana. There are 6 water pots. I'm not a great artist. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 water pots, I think it is, at the Cana marriage feast. The Catholic sees these water pots, and the phenomena are, he knows that the essence of what's inside the water pots is water. Because the phenomena are the phenomena of water. Maybe one of them tipped his finger in and tasted it. But in any case, it was obviously water. Because he heard them saying, go out to the well. The mother said, go and fill 6 water pots. And so it's water. Then he hears a conversation going over the other side of the room with Jesus of Galilee. And then the Catholic sees that something, the water has turned red. He then sees that the water is, that the, what used to be the water is poured out on the tables. He sees the guests tasting it. He has a swig himself. Hey, it's delicious wine. So the phenomena have changed very clearly from the phenomena of water to the phenomena of wine. Now the Catholic is able to read behind that. And when the Catholic picks up firstly the phenomena of water, and then the phenomena of wine in the same 6 phenomenal water pots, he says, hey, that is a miracle. When the phenomena, when the essence of water is changed into the essence of wine, and not just the phenomena, because he's a Catholic, when the appearances change like that, and the reality, as everybody tastes and everybody tries it, it's clear that it's wine, it's no longer water. He says, that's a miracle. And he Again, the mind, the phenomena don't tell him that it's a miracle. I mean, the phenomena give him the material of the miracle, but the phenomena don't give him the essence of the miracle. They give him the appearances of the miracle. But it's his mind that says, hey, water doesn't usually change into wine. But I know that the essence of that was water. And I know that that essence is now wine. Hey, water doesn't change into wine without God intervening. So this is God. This is a miracle. So you see again, for somebody to recognize a miracle, his mind has to be at work on the phenomena, reading behind the phenomena that something in the essences has changed in a way that it can't possibly normally change. Therefore, a miracle as a miracle is on the other side of the phenomena. Well, again, you put Kant in front of that, so the Catholic's mind picks up the miracle. And the miracle, again, imposes itself. His mind is passive to the miracle. His mind is not creating the miracle, his mind is passive to the miracle. What was recognizably, essentially water, is now equally recognizably the essence of wine. No question about it. Behind that change in the appearances, there's a change in the essences. And who can only change the essences? It must be God. So again, we've got the argument, the mind climbs from the change in the appearances, climbs from what's behind such a change in the appearances to the worker of the miracle. But it's the mind that does it. The eyes don't say that the white ball makes the red ball move. The eyes simply pick up white moving, stopping, red starting to move. That's all the eyes pick up. The eyes and the tongue pick up water or wine or colorless red. That's all that the eyes pick up. The eyes don't pick up the miracle. It's the mind that picks up the miracle. Now, with Kant, beyond the miracle I can't go. Behind the phenomena I can't go. So since the miracle as miracle is behind the phenomena, I can't pick up the miracle. So miracles are wiped out. All that we've got, once more, is just one big question mark. Question mark. I don't know what that water, I don't know if it was really water. I don't know if it's really wine. And that's how people today react to miracles. How do I know? I don't know. I don't know whether that was really. The Lord God today can work a miracle under a person's nose, and he would say, I don't know what's going on. So, again, you put Kant in front of that, and it's just one big question mark. And the mind imposes, and Kant will say, oh yes, it's miracles, because the idea that this Jesus of Galilee made the water into wine made them all feel good. So they all created a miracle. The mind created the miracle. So the miracle is a fabrication of people's minds. It makes them feel good. Okay, no problem. But there's nothing objective about it. Don't let's talk about anything objectively. The object is unknowable. The essence of the object is unknowable. So, away with miracles. All that we've got is a question mark. One big question mark. Now, let's take thirdly, revelation. Same principle. Here is Frankenstein. Well, he's firstly the Catholic Frankenstein. First, he's going to be a Catholic. And here is, please excuse me, the Galilean. Okay. This is Jesus of Nazareth. He doesn't look much like him, but that's who he's meant to be. Our Lord talks, our Lord speaks, our Lord reveals. Our Lord, the fisherman, the carpenter's son of Galilee, presents his apostles with a lot of phenomena. The Sermon on the Mount. Maybe he spoke for an hour, 2 hours, I don't know. And it beat on everybody's eardrums. And at the same time, they watched this man standing. And our Lord was revealing the new law. He was revealing the Son of God. So a lot of Galileans at that time watch the phenomena of Jesus of Nazareth, and some of them said, these phenomena are such that my intelligence tells me that this is God. This man, he's revealing to me that behind this son of Joseph dressed in Galilean clothing, which is what I pick up, and speaking perhaps with a Galilean accent, which is what my ears pick up, behind this is coming to me the revelation of the Son of God, IHS. Who do men say that I am? Some say Jeremiah, some say Elias, some say, and who do you say that I am? Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. See, Peter is recognizing that behind these appearances, which strike the Pharisees as absolutely nothing extraordinary, and strike most people walk down the street as Jesus walks down the other side of the street and don't even turn their heads. The appearances are nothing really very special. But those who stop and listen and get to know over a few months and maybe a couple of years, they finally say, this is, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. In other words, and it's not, again, it's obviously not Peter's eyes, which have simply picked up color, nor Peter's eardrums that are telling him this is the Son of God. It's Peter's mind, which is working on what his eyes and his eardrums have been giving him for the last 2 years. His mind is working on it, and his mind tells him this is God. Because there's no other explanation of the majesty and dignity and truth and beauty of these phenomena. So Peter's mind says, this is God. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. But once more, Kant comes up against these phenomena. So there's revelation. There is the Son of God through natural means, through a Galilean, through a human being, revealing himself, God revealing himself, the second person revealing the divinity. Philip, he who has seen the Son has seen the Father. Jesus, show us the Father. Philip, you have been with me all this time, and do not realize he who has seen the Son has seen the Father. Behind these appearances is the Godhead, as the mind can pick up. Same thing with Pete, with doubting Thomas. I won't believe until I put my hand in his side, and so on. So, all right, Thomas, put your hand in my side. So Thomas believes his senses. He wants sensation. He's not a Cartesian. He will see, for him, seeing and touching is believing. He wants the scientific evidence. So he puts his hand in the side, and he sees, yes, it's for real. Then he falls down on his knees and says, my Lord and my God. It's not his fingers that picked up God. It's the mind reading behind what his fingers were telling him. Namely, this is a real man with a real gap in his side. Just where Jesus a few days ago got skewered by the lance of Longinus. So his mind tells him this is God. So the mind goes beyond what the senses. Now that is a supernatural grasp. And with Peter it's the same thing. But in any case, they're grasping by faith what is being revealed to them in the realm of nature. A hand being put in a slot is a completely natural and sense thing. But behind the natural and sense thing, Thomas and Peter read very much more, and it's completely reasonable to read it. But for Kant, nothing. For Kant, behind the phenomenon of the Galilean, once more, there's just a Ding and Sich. I don't even know if it's a human being, let alone God. Might be an elephant, a donkey, a monkey, a tree, a pear tree. I just don't know. So, if I want to say that that's God, if it makes me feel good, by all means, but please, don't pretend that it's coming from outside. It's my mind that's putting God in it. Therefore, what you can see is that the sunset, the water pots, the Galilean, between them and my mind, there's just one great big gash. I have got no right to go beyond the frontier of the phenomena. I don't know what's beyond the phenomena. I know the phenomena, but what's beyond, I don't know. Therefore, the author of nature, the author of miracles, the author of revelation, trash can. And that's just the beginning of it. Jim.
Would it be fair to say that
unbelieving Jews were everyday Kenshins?
Kind of, yes. They're refusing the objective truth. Yes, kind of. But they hadn't made it into a system. No, the Pharisees had not made it into a philosophical system. The end result is kind of the same. But what Kant did that nobody had ever done before was made the refusal of the object into a system. The Pharisees will not have said, I don't know the object. The Pharisees will have said that this is not God. But they didn't say that anybody behind these phenomena is unknowable.
But if you turn it on its head, could you say then that the Kantians were latter-day Pharisees?
Sort of, yes.
That explains quite a bit in history.
But the end result is the same. It arrives at the same result. Only Kant is much more devastating. Because Kant is making refusal of objective truth into a universal system. And the Pharisees never did that. The Pharisees never corrupted minds to that point. If the Pharisees had known Kant, they might have been delighted and said, Kant, you're a hell of a good guy. But Kant couldn't then have swung it, which was your question a few moments ago, because far too many people had far too much common sense. Kant can only swing it when the world is already fairly corrupt with at least 200 years of Protestantism, nearly 300 years, 1780, 1580, a good 200 years of Protestantism. And the whole modern world had to be fairly rotted with Protestantism before Kant could start to take off. And then liberalism is what really enabled Kant to bite. Okay? So this nonsense is only acceptable in a pretty corrupt world. And John Paul II, talking all of his nonsense, John Paul II can only get away with it because the world because Catholics are so foolish. If only a few more Catholics had a little more horse sense, there's no way that John Paul II could seriously get away with the things he's saying. Too many people would be saying, Holy Father, you're talking nonsense. And if enough people said to him, Holy Father, you're talking nonsense, he would backtrack. Okay, you don't feel good about it, then look, I'll tell you something else to make you feel good. I'll tell you that 2 and 2 is 4. Does that make you feel good? Yes, Holy Father. All right, well, I'll say 2 and 2 is 4 from now on. Ah, thank you, Holy Father. But is it any better when such a man says 2 and 2 is 4 than when he says 2 and 2 is 5? It's even more dangerous because 2 and 2 is 4 in his head is no longer resting upon objective truth. It's resting upon what he now realizes makes many people feel good. And that's the way Cardinal Ratzinger and Pope John Paul II operate, basically. They're giving out, you know, what makes people feel good. And so even when they're traditional, they're not really traditional at all. You can't trust them when they say, let's have the Trident in Mass. Because they're not doing it on the basis of objective reality and commandments of God. They're doing it on the basis of, the people here like a Trident in Mass, let's give it to them. Okay, if it makes them feel good.
People-pleasers?
Yes, it's still on a basis not of the will of God, but on a basis of people-pleasing. In other words, the basic principle of the people command God has not been changed. And when, at least when they say 2 and 2 is 5, you can recognize that they're off the wall. But when these people say 2 and 2 is 4, it's more dangerous because they resemble people who are sane. They look like people who are sane.
Cardinals fell on celebrating the traditional Mass. Dangerous.
I think Spellman was already into the game, I'm afraid, yes. Jim.
Did Kant deny the law of cause and effect? Did he deny that?
He transposed it from object reality into subjective thinking. The law of causality is created by my mind.
Oh, okay.
The whole of reality shifts from outside to the inside. The name for it in philosophy is subjectivism. Kant is the prince of subjectivism. All reality now takes place inside my own head. And as you said, virtual reality is the same kind of principle. Yes?
The moral law was in me, and the stars above me are sufficient to prove God. So,
yes, but his proof of God is entirely bogus. It's he proves God by the will rather than by the intellect. In other words, more or less, he lands on his feet. Therefore, God exists. What I want is true. God equals what I want. Therefore, God equals true. See, the conclusion is correct, but the basis upon which he rests the conclusion is completely wild. So you see, once again, the modernists can end up with the exterior of the bottle looks just like it used to, but the substance is completely changed. God now rests upon what I want. You want God, then he exists for you. You don't want him, then he doesn't exist for you. Whatever you want is true. Because the mind can no longer get reality, it's the will that gets reality from now on. Which is insane. Doctor?
Number two, the miracle of Cana.
Yes.
The accidents changed. A Cantesian would not see that as a miracle. If our modern church member Cantesian, it's impossible to believe in transubstantiation.
Yes.
It's absolutely impossible.
It can't make any sense. It can't make any sense. Because
you can't even believe about the accidents in front of
you. You have no idea what's going on behind appearances. So if the appearances change and they say you don't know what's going on, the appearances stay the same, yet they don't know what's going on.
But essentially, they don't really believe in it, but they do, because we believe the essence changes. We assign the essence.
It makes you feel good. To think that beneath the appearances of bread and wine is really Jesus Christ. If that makes you feel good, yeah, sure. Oh, yes. But it's on a completely different basis. Therefore, transubstantiation is true, but transubstantiation is what I want, or what I want is true, transubstantiation is what I want, therefore transubstantiation is true. Yeah, they arrive at the same conclusion, but on the substance is completely different. The appearance is the same, but the substance is completely changed. They've kept all the bottles in the pharmacist, but everyone has been emptied out and refilled overnight with poison. Instead of medicine, you've got poison. So, God as the author of nature, miracles as miracles, and external revelation, in other words, revelation coming to me from outside, not God speaking directly inside me, but revelation coming outside from, for instance, the Galilean, as I shall call him, all of that's the other side of the phenomenon, and therefore it's all unknowable, and therefore it's all the trash can. It all goes into the trash can. Now, therefore, God, miracles, and revelation do not exist outside. Outside, on the other side of the phenomenon, is simply one big question mark. They don't come from outside, but they do come from somewhere. They do come from somewhere. They are, as given facts, they come from somewhere. You know, I do experience God, and I do experience miracles in life, and I do experience revelation. So since it's not coming from outside, because the outside is unknowable, but it is there, then it must be coming from inside. So, therefore, and we're moving into the principle of vital immanence, therefore God, miracles, and revelation come from inside. Now, what's this vital immanence business? Firstly, immanence is from the Latin, meaning remaining within. Immanens, remaining within. And vita in Latin means life, and vitalis means of life. Therefore, vital is of life. Vital immanence is what is living inside. So where do God, miracles, and revelation come from? They are all living inside me. Therefore, the God comes from inside me. Because he doesn't come from outside, but he is there. Therefore, when I stand in front of the sunset, it makes me feel good. That's God. The feeling good is God. Because he feels like God. Similarly to the miracles, they don't come from outside because I'm not allowed to step beyond, I don't know anything beyond the phenomena. Therefore, the miracles come from inside. The revelation, I'm not allowed to step beyond the phenomena of the Galilean, because no one knows anything beyond the other side of the phenomena. But the Galilean makes me feel all cozy inside. He makes me feel charismatic. And therefore, that's revelation. That's God. That's the Galilean. The Galilean is God. But it all comes from inside. It doesn't come from outside. It comes from somewhere. Therefore, it comes from inside. It's something living from inside me. And that's the principle of vital immanence. So you've got the principle of phenomenist agnosticism. Agnosticism means I don't know. It's the Greek gignosko, know, and a privative alpha. Therefore, I don't know. So agnosticism is I don't know the Ding an sich. Phenomenism means beyond the phenomena. Phenomenist agnosticism, I have no idea what's on the other side of the phenomena. That's the negative principle that just bulldozes the building site. And we will see not one scrap of the Catholic religion can resist this bulldozer. The bulldozer is radical. All objective reality is just emptied out, straight down the drain. What's it going to be replaced by? Well, these things are experienced by me. The experiences don't come from outside, therefore the experiences must come from the inside. It's quite a simple argument, and to that extent it's logical. So all of this, the beautiful God of the sunset, the God of miracles, and the God of revelation, they all come from inside. So vital immanence, it's all something living inside me. Religion is therefore they come from within. Now religion is a form of human life, which in Latin is vita, and the adjective is vitalis. Therefore, religion comes from man's life within. And that's another key principle. That really deserves a double underlining and capitals again. Religion comes from man's life within. Religion comes from inside. It cannot come from outside. It comes from somewhere. It must come from inside. It cannot come from outside, phenomenist agnosticism. It does come from somewhere because it's a fact of life. Therefore, it must come from inside, vital immanence, living insideness. That's vital immanence. Big Latin words, what they mean is living insideness. Therefore, religion comes from man's life within. And there you've got in brackets on your little thing, pi of vital immanence. That doesn't mean 3.14159. It means it's short for principle. That's the principle of vital immanence. Pi is used here. The Greek letter pi is used for principle of vital immanence. Now, all of man's life comes from the sense of his heart and from his needs. Therefore, capital letters, religion comes from the needs of man's heart. So we've got a big bleeding hearts religion. That's where it all comes from. So all religion comes from my big bleeding heart. My heart has such needs.
I'm starting to feel it.
Are you feeling tingly and sincere all over? That's what you should be feeling.
They never refer to a conservative as having a bleeding heart. It's always a liberal.
You got it. Yeah. But they say if the conservatives pretend that they have an objective religion, they're simply responding to the needs of their bleeding hearts. Yes?
I think I missed somewhere how they jumped from the previous system that was all based on the intelligence.
Yes.
Of the heart. Where's the connection there?
Okay. They come from somewhere. Therefore, they come from within, right? Now, religion is a form of human life. Religion comes from man's life within. Man's life comes from the sense of the heart and from his needs.
Read
paragraph 7. Take a look at paragraph 7. I'm sorry, I haven't still got your texts. I beg your pardon. Let's have a look at this. When natural theology has been destroyed and the road to revelation has been closed by the rejection of the arguments of credibility from the object, and when all external revelation is absolutely denied, because the other side of the Galilean I have no idea, but it is clear that the explanation for religion cannot be sought outside, it must therefore be looked for inside. And since religion is a form of life, the explanation must certainly be found in the life of man. And so we've got the principle of religion being inside, religious immanence. Moreover, the first actuation, so to speak, of every vital phenomenon, and religion, as noted above, is a living phenomenon. The first actuation is due to a certain need or impulsion. It comes from a need. That's what he says. The first actuation comes from some need. Speaking more particularly of life, the origin is a movement of the heart, which movement is called a sense. Okay? It's very condensed, very, very condensed. But so the needs of the heart generate this experience inside the intelligence, which then projects upon the phenomena what it needs.
The heart then is the source of the need.
Yes. So the new religion is going to be love, love, love. L-U-V, L-U-V, L-U-V. In it, lovely. Lovely, lovely, lovely. And the hills are alive with the sound of loveliness. And everybody's sweet and everybody loves. Therefore, as God is the object of religion, we must conclude that faith, which is the basis and foundation of all religion, must consist in a certain interior sense or feeling, originating in a need of the divine. This is about the same time as Sigmund Freud, interestingly. So, you know, these modernists, about the same time as Freud. So what you start, you see, religion is an experience. Religion is a fact of life. God, revelation, miracles, people experience that. So it's a fact. We can't deny facts. Now, they can't be coming from outside because the other side of the phenomena we have no idea of. Therefore, this experience is coming from somewhere inside. This religious experience is a phenomenon of life. And life comes in man from the heart. Therefore, religion is coming from the heart. Does that make sense? That's how. That's very condensed, but that's how he's arguing it.
Could they not as well have said that because this experience is perceived with the intelligence, that religion is created by the intelligence, why do they pick the heart necessarily?
Because the intelligence is pushed around by the heart on this system. The intelligence is unhooked from the object. The intelligence is now responding to the interior needs of man. The intelligence is no longer responding to what's out there. Right? Because it can't. On Kant's system, the intelligence can't respond to what's out there because the bridge with the intelligible object is cut. Right? So the intelligence is all dressed up with nowhere to go. So it's fed from inside. It's the heart that moves the intelligence. What I want is truth. I want God. Therefore, God is truth. Got it? The appearance is the same, God is truth, but the substance is totally different. It's now totally me, 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 instead of reality, reality, reality. Reality is no longer the master of me, but I am the master of reality. The scales are being completely tipped. And man, instead of God being above man, man is now above God. That's the game. It's very simple, really.
I wouldn't understand if I hadn't been exposed to Protestant preaching for the last couple of weeks. This all makes sense.
Yeah.
The way they see it.
Yes.
You're Protestant.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. The Protestants, you were, Jim was saying that the Pharisees, is Canon the same as the Pharisees? You're saying it's the same as Protestants. Wherever men deny the reality, they are implicitly Kantians. But what Kant did was to make it into philosophy, which had never been done before. And that's when you're in real trouble.
For instance, if I go downtown and get drunk, but I know that it's the wrong thing to do, that's a sin, but it's just a weakness. But if I go downtown and get drunk and say that getting drunk is a good thing, that's a completely different ball game. Because now the rot is no longer just in the fact that I like getting drunk. The rot is now in the mind. Right? And I'm adapting my principles to my rotten practice. Rotten practice, but good principles, is much better than rotten principles and good practice. Kant did not get drunk and he didn't womanize, but he was deadly. Whereas I remember once visiting in Ireland an Irish priest who was drunk all day long. But he nevertheless was a successful parish priest. Because the drunkenness was just a weakness of the flesh, but the religion kept on coming straight from the mind. And therefore the essentials he had, and the drunkenness, the parish lived with it. The people knew that he was drunk all day long. They didn't expect him to be anything else. And those are Catholics. That's a wise Catholic reaction. But today, your Puritans, you know, drunkenness. But if he says that 2 and 2 is 5, that's not a problem. It's drunkenness that's getting a problem. See, people today have got it completely wrong. Principles are much more important than practice. But people today have got no sense of the importance of principles. No sense of the importance of doctrine. No sense of the importance of principles. So people today are just all over the place. If religion comes from man's life within, therefore religion comes from the needs of man's heart. And then we immediately begin applying this principle. This is the application of these deadly principles, absolutely deadly principles. What does faith become? Faith is then an inner sense. It's a sort of, it's the vomit rising up from my heart, which I then splash all over the object. That's what faith is. Here's the Galilean. If I believe in the Galilean, it's because the Galilean phenomena so interests me that it awakes my need for God, and my need for God produces God, which I then splash all over the phenomena. So imagine the vomit of my needs splattered all over the Galilean, and that is the modernist idea of faith. Now you know why the Pope says this is... Oh, you haven't had the text, but if you read it, he says, this is insanity. Understand it, who can? Absolutely. It is absolutely blasphemous. It's horrible. Absolutely horrible. But he says they're audacious. They don't shrink from anything. They stop at nothing. This is the mess that we're in. This is the mess that we're in. Now you know why the church is in such a mess. Because you can't get more basic than that. When you attack the mind, when you attack the prime principles of the mind hooking onto reality, when you unhook the mind from reality, you can't disorient a man deeper than that. Even, you know, the guys that danced around the golden calf didn't pretend that, you know, we can't know the object. But this is what the modern world is into. And this is why the modern world is so deeply sick. And it's got everything to do with Immanuel Kant. If there's one man, it's the two men, Descartes and Kant. Those are the two men. Well, we will drop it there and pick up again at 2:30.